Welcome back to PaleoCast for a final day of coverage of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology Conference in downtown LA. This episode was a few days late due to the sheer volume of material to get through, hangovers, dodgy airport Wi-Fi, and so apologies for the delay. The whole evening was pretty full on, as was the conference in general, so I'd like to pass on our thanks to the SVP and to the hosts of the event. It's been great attending both the SVP and the earlier GSA, particularly in seeing them both through the eyes of a paleontologist and as a member of the press. I've learnt a lot, met a lot of old friends, made a lot of new friends, and just had a great time in general, and I hope you all had a good time listening too. Don't forget to comment, subscribe, and share our podcast with others who might not have been able to attend either conference. In December, we're set to live stream and record events at the Paleontological Association Annual General Meeting in Zurich, Switzerland, bringing you even closer to events. So we'll see you all then.
Joined by Darren Naish, who has a poster this time on the aerodynamics of Microraptor. Microraptor is supposed to be a four-winged deinonychosaur, and it's pretty important for figuring out how experimental initial flight phases were. So, hi Darren.
Yeah, hi.
Cool. So, do you want to give us the two-minute elevator pitch for this one?
So, Microraptor, this amazing dinosaur with long feathers on its hind limbs as well as its fore limbs, and some kind of fan-shaped tail structure as well. It's generally regarded as a glider of some sort, and several studies have tried to model the aerodynamic behaviour of this animal. They've often concluded that it was kind of like a specialist kind of flying squirrel-style dinosaur. But we wanted to look at this anew using the wind tunnel that we have at University of Southampton. So Colin Palmer designed this fantastically accurate model with real feathers on it, and we flew it in a wind tunnel. There's some controversy as to the hind limb posture and the feather orientation, so tested various different configurations. And what do we conclude? Well, basically, it performs pretty well. It's not a super specialized glider. It's not a flying squirrel dinosaur, but it does glide well. But it's got very high drag, no matter what you go for the leg orientation and the feather orientation. And I think the take-home message from that is that, yes, it can glide, but it's not a particularly good glider. It's got to be jumping at great speed from reasonable height in order to perform well aerodynamically. And the idea that it's kind of like good at it but not brilliant at it, I would say, fits with all the other data that we have on the ecology and behaviour of this animal. I mean, you know, this recent study about one specimen having fish in the stomach contents, which is in keeping with the idea that, yeah, it can glide and, yeah, it can climb, but it runs around the ground and it eats animals on the ground as well. So
it's quite an experimental type of flight style, I guess, for around the time.
Well, there's obviously a lot going on in Paravian evolution in the Jurassic and Cretaceous. Lots of different configurations of wings and long hind limb feathers, long hind limb wings and such. And this is one apparently very successful technique. But it's kind of a different way of doing this.
So, were there actual other birds or bird-like dinosaurs around at this time which had or were capable of powered flight, or was it just
powered
kind of gliding?
This is controversial, with different people having different opinions. But I don't know. I mean, this is one of Gareth Dyke's projects, and Gareth is of the opinion, together with his colleague John Nuds, that the feather shafts aren't strong enough in some of these feathered Maniraptorans, non-bird Maniraptorans, and also in early birds like in Futurosaurus. They reckon they're not strong enough for flapping flight, and therefore they're gliding. And some people say that matches with ideas about, you know, how much forelimb motion they could use. That's one point of view. Other people do say these animals were capable of true flapping flight, that they had sufficient pectoral musculature for it and enough forelimb motion. So there are different views. But I don't know. I mean, it kind of seems to me like you've got a little bit of everything. You've got some animals that are experimenting with true flapping flight, others that are gliding, others that are... I mean, we know of other non-bird Paravians, where the forelimbs are too short for them to be using the wings aerodynamically. So are they secondarily flightless? Do they have these large feathers because they have a display function? Those are all good questions that people are testing at the moment.
So this week I've already appeared on the Paleo After Dark podcast, and here from the Paleo After Dark podcast is Amanda Falk appearing on the Paleocast podcast. And Amanda's got a poster on the plumage and soft tissues of Confuciusornis. So getting feathers preserved on a bird is pretty rare, isn't it? Especially as you go further back in time.
Right. Feathers in general are very hard to preserve. They're keratinous structures. Keratin is a soft tissue. It doesn't preserve very well, if at all. And the specimens that we get out of the Lower Cretaceous Zhouhou group in northeastern China display absolutely fabulous feather preservation. And that has allowed us to actually look at how the feathers are arranged in these very basal birds, like Confuciusornis. The nice thing about Confuciusornis is that there are thousands of specimens that are now known. So we get a very, very good sample size.
So the feathers on Confuciusornis, are they anything similar to what we'd see in modern birds?
Yes, they are essentially identical. The only thing that's really different are the tail feathers in Confuciusornis, which have sort of been the subject of debate for some time. The original interpretation with it, they were approximately featureless ribbon-like structures that you see in things like Birds of Paradise, where it's literally just a flat sheet of keratin. But then if you go and you actually perform what we've done is laser fluorescence, and you're using a very high-powered laser and then specialized camera filters for any kind of camera, I just use a Nikon, you can actually cause matrix to backlight, matrix to fluoresce, which will backlight carbonized structures like feathers. And so we can actually see things like internal morphology of the feathers and see exactly what we're doing. And so that has sort of really informed us that, yeah, these are probably rachis-dominated feathers. They're just big rachises.
So this bird could fly then?
Oh, yeah, easily. Yeah, that shouldn't even be a question anymore. Although there was a study some years ago, I think back in 2010, 2011, by some guys from England that stated that the rachises were very weak on the primaries of Confuciusornis. There have been previous responses to that sort of said, no, they're not. They're very robust. And then my work has sort of really, really hammered that home. That, yeah, the building on Zhang et al. And Paul et al. In response to this other paper. No, these rachises are really strongly robust. They're very, equally as robust, if not more so than in modern birds. So the question shouldn't be, could Confuciusornis fly? It should be, how well could it fly?
How well could it fly?
Probably not very well. It didn't have a big keel. But it does have a very broad, rounded wing. It doesn't have this long, tapered wing that's typical of fast-flying birds like swifts or swallows, which is kind of what these guys were implying, because it does have very, very long primaries. But when you look at the relative shape of the wing and the relative length of the primaries to each other, they're not super-duper long. It's a very rounded, broad wing. And the secondaries are very long, too. So the primaries, FYI, those are the feathers that come off the hand. Secondaries are the feathers that come off the ulna.
And so with this bird being so bird-like, can it tell us anything about the transition from dinosaurs to birds? Or is it too far into the bird side of the scale?
It really probably is too far to the bird side of the scale to tell us anything about origin of flight or things like that. But it could tell us things about origin of feathers, looking at the real morphology of these tail feathers and other things like that. It could do that for us.
So a lot of work on feathers at the moment seems to be on the coloration of feathers. I mean, there's been quite a few talks here, and Jakob Winter, who's been on Paleocast before, has talked a little bit about that. So can you tell anything about the colors of Confuciusornis?
Yes, we actually do have a color pattern preserved. So, and that, to me, is a lot better than any evidence of melanosomes, because you can actually look at it and go, oh, hey, that's an actual color pattern that we've got there. So look for that, hopefully, coming up in a hopefully prominent journal, hopefully fairly soon.
Thanks very much, Amanda.
Of course, anytime.
We're here now with Kesa Werinen, who has a cool-looking poster on crocodilomorph diversity from the infamous Clovelly Formation in North America, and she's been doing some kind of cool morphometrics on the teeth of these things. So quite often these guys are found as isolated tooth elements. So hi Kesa, tell us what you've got.
Hi, okay, so we have a lot of isolated crocodilomorph teeth from the Clovelly Formation. We wanted to see if we could use them to say whether or not there are in fact four different crocodilomorph groups present in the area. So we had a reference group full of extant crocodilomorphs, and here, I guess you can't really see the graphs, but we have some graphs with the tooth dimensions, and we saw enough separation on them to want to proceed with the fossil teeth. So we looked at the length, width, and height of the teeth, the patterning and count of striations, noted molariformity, the strength of striations, whether or not they were weak or strong. Anyway, we put this all together in R, and we got this. These graphs here, which showed... Which no one can see, again, yeah. But if you could see them, you would see that there's enough separation on the axes when you take all of that data and all of those measurements into account that we can say that there are four different crocodilomorph groups present. And a next step would be having a skull with teeth in it, obviously would be ideal.
Did we not find many complete croc remains then?
No, we were looking at mostly isolated stuff.
Okay.
Yeah.
How come you only get teeth then, more than just, you know, post-cranial or cranial remains?
Well,
just a taphonomic bias?
Well, we're looking at microfossil bone beds, so there you just find a lot of teeth.
Cool.
Yeah, these are tiny teeth.
Okay, so we might actually have a hitherto unknown high diversity of crocs around this time, so which would be really, really useful considering, I guess, croc diversity is... at an all-time low in the early Cretaceous. So if you've actually found like a new way of assessing diversity, then that could be really cool. So now we're here with Deanna Brandau from the University of Utah, and she's got a wicked-looking poster with tons of cool pictures. And it's all about crocodiliform feeding traces on ceratopsid dinosaurs in the Upper Cretaceous, so of the US. And yeah, it looks pretty awesome. How do you know these are croc feeding traces on these things?
Well, from what I've been reading and talking with more of the experts, crocodiles tend to bite along transverse or perpendicular or even oblique to the long axis of the element. They tend to be, the traces are U-shaped in cross-section. A lot of crocodiles, but some theropods can actually have the, when they leave a trace, they'll hook it, they'll curve it on one end. And usually a lot of times they're shallow, and then if they have something like a score, which is a long, slender trace of the tooth, they'll leave a bisected mark in the middle of that U-shaped valley. Theropods tend to leave more a V-shape, and they're a little deeper. So I just got confirmation that I have both a theropod and crocodile, but I also have two different sizes in both sites from the comparables. These are ceratopsians. They're disassociated, so the elements are not in lie position. They're disarticulated, but they are associated.
Okay, yeah.
And there's no head, there's no neck. Only one has a few tail elements, and the other one has one limb element. All the other elements are gone, except ribs and vertebrae. I have bite marks on both right and left side of the ribs, and both top and bottom side suggest that the animals are coming in, at least at some point, defleshing, and there's a question of whether it happened during, you know, at death or before final. We know that it occurred before final deposition. The animals seem to have been float and float as a partially to fully articulated specimens that floated not very far from the death site, and then they have these other taphonomic modifications. So they're in water, they were deposited in water-laden environment, high water table. They have water rot. They have fungal etching from plants. They have weathering from the sun and or the soil, depending on how face up or face down of the element. And then they also have some breakage and articulation from transport. But it looks like at some point before deposition and at least at death, there is feeding by theropods from the one-sided crocodile, both large and small, and the other one by both the large and small individual. And some of the elements are even warped and have deformation of the bone.
So can we tell if this was like a predation or scavenging thing, or is it impossible to tell at the moment?
Well, it's hard to tell whether the animal was getting predated, had predation, or it, like this is the cause of death. There's no limbs or head or neck, so there's no way to know. We only know that from the traces they were getting meat off the bones. You can say there was defleshing. You just don't know whether that was dismemberment of an element or whether they were just eating it, you know, at some point. The fact that we have both longitudinal to the bone and at an angle suggests that there is probably both the theropods were pulling meat off the long bones and the ribs, and that the crocodiles were coming in from the side. But then there's different types of tooth marks suggested that there's different pressures of the teeth, and they're coming in at different angles and different pressure and depth.
Did we see any evidence of the bones rehealing, perhaps? Because that would be pretty good evidence that it was hunting.
We don't. Most of these, we would see some type, but at this point, there is no paleopathologies. We do, however, see one bone that has insect traces, and the insects, it's like a dermistid beetle that is also right around the area where their tooth marks are. We have three sets of serial pitting where there's multiple teeth marks that are basically where you can see multiple teeth that come down at one time, and that seems to be pretty uncommon.
Yeah, okay. Cool. Thanks very much for your time, Deanna.
Right,
sounds great.
You.
Right, so now we're moving on to something a bit different. We've got theropod egg sites from the Lorenia Formation, and I'm joined by Femke Halverda, who's based in Munich. So cool. First of all, where are these eggs from?
So this work was based on dinosaur eggs and eggshells from the Lorenia Formation, from the Lorenia area that's in central west Portugal. The area is pretty special because it's very fossil rich and the outcrops are late Jurassic. So there are actually not so many dinosaur eggs known from the Jurassic. All the eggshells known so far, or most of them, are from the Cretaceous, so there's a pretty big gap. I mean, dinosaurs laid eggs in the Jurassic and the Triassic as well, so this site is pretty special in that it's very rich in fossils and very rich in dinosaur eggs.
Cool. So what have you been doing with them? Have you been chopping them open or incubating them?
What we did was, well, we were preparing fossil blocks. So the eggs are found in both clutches and isolated eggshells. What we did was collect blocks from the field and prepare them very carefully, of course. And the eggshells were just collected by sieving sediment. And, well, loose eggshells, that's easier to, as you said, chop up. So what we did with most of them was make thin sections, both like tangential and for a cross-section. We did that by hand. It's pretty hard work, but it does pay off because you get beautiful thin sections, which we then took to SEM, and we also made macro photos.
SEM for the uninformed is?
Oh, it's scanning electron microscopy.
Okay, cool. So what's it used for?
It's used to see, you know, very great microscopic details, and you get like nice 3D pictures.
Cool.
Of and the why we do multiple approaches to scanning and to photography is because you see different characteristics through different methods. So, for example, we also used polarized light microscopy to bring out the internal structure of the eggshells. And then the SEM shows very well the overall results and the rugosity, for example, of the egg surface.
Is it possible to tell kind of which dinosaur laid these eggs, you know, based on sympatric species?
Well, we think we kind of, we have two good suspects. That's mainly because we were lucky to find dinosaur embryo bones in association with the eggs. So it's never 100% sure if they were inside of the eggs, but it's, you know, it's a pretty high chance that they were, or that they were just hatched. So we have two main dinosaur egg types from this area, from different localities, and by far the most common eggshell type is a type we call pre-prismatolithus. It's a mouthful, but it's basically it's a prismatic eggshell So it's made of its prisms. It's quite thin. The porosity is not really high, and the outer structure is very smooth. And we find a lot of these. So it's not sure if these nests were communal or not, but we find a lot of these, and these are associated with Laurianosaurus, which is a type of Allosaurus. And then you have the second type, which is very different. It's very verbose. It's much thicker. The porosity is much higher. Also, the eggs were probably larger. And this one, this is what I find really cool, is associated with a Torvosaurus embryo. Now, Torvosaurus is like the largest predator from that time.
Okay, awesome.
But then we found an embryo, which is teeny tiny. But it's so cute. But that's really cool that you can directly associate eggshell types with dinosaurs, because usually what you have is you find an egg type and then you can say, well, maybe it's a theropod, maybe it's a sauropod. But now we can name the egg type, and then we can name the dinosaur species, which is important for the paleoecological reconstruction.
Alright.
So
awesome. Well, thank you very much, Femke.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so moving from one egg type to another, I'm here with Jade and Daniel now from the Department of Earth Sciences in Montana State. And they have theropod eggshells again, but this time from the US. They're theropods again. Did you guys find these by yourselves, or were they part of a collection? Or?
No, these were actually collected in 1994 by Horner and Maxwell.
Okay.
From the Unit 7 of the Cloverly Formation, and recently sent to us by request so that we can look at them further based on a publication of theirs.
All right, cool. So what have you found from them so far?
Well, what we were looking at is trying to get at the validity of diagnosing eggshell based on gross morphology. That's frequently done at a lot of sites where eggshells are just collected and diagnosed briefly based on the ornamentation to say, oh, there are four types or five types, or these are sauropod or theropod eggshells at this site. And it turns out that when you visually inspect these, it looks like there are maybe three distinct types, possibly even five. But once you cut them up and section them and look at them under the microscope, the microstructure of our sample is actually identical. And so we looked at these under cathode luminescence in SEM and in plain light microscopy, as well as and plain polar and cross polars. And it looks like what we're actually seeing is taphonomic alteration to varying degrees of the eggshell that's making it appear in gross morphological view to be different types of eggshell. So what we see in this top image right here is some nice biologically normal, essentially, nodes that are... Right, of course. And you can see that these accretion lines in this nodous and ridged eggshell actually follow that ornamentation, which is somewhat diagnostic of the taxa itself. Right, it's very pretty. The CL pictures are amazing. And once you move down through, once you move down through, you can see that the nodes are becoming a bit planed off, and the top of this is becoming irregular. It doesn't look as biologically intact anymore. And then once we get down to the most eroded specimen, in our opinion, you see these very, very distinct pits, and the accretion lines of the eggshell actually terminate against those pits, which in unaltered specimens does not occur. The accretion lines, like I said, they undulate sort of with the ornamentation, whereas in the altered eggshell, they're abutting right up against those pits, which indicates that they are an erosional or dissolution feature. And then you can see in the CL, they're lit up much more brightly in the highly eroded eggshell, which indicates there's a higher amount of diagenetic material, so secondary calcite and possibly some magnesium and iron.
It looks like you've got some kind of phylogenetic tree here of eggshells or something. Is that what we're
looking at? Yeah, that's exactly what we're seeing. We added this eggshell to the phylogenetic analysis of Jin and others, 2010. We're asking, who might have laid these eggs? What are the relationships to other egg types with identified embryos and other OO taxa without known embryos? And so we put it into this data matrix because it also includes Deinonychus eggshell, which is the only other known theropod eggshell from the Cloverleaf Formation. And so my analysis was unable to resolve this eggshell, More specifically, with in respect to its relationship with Deinonychus and Macrolongitalithus, which is an egg type that's known from slightly stratigraphically higher, the Wayan Formation in Idaho, which Jade is currently working on for her thesis. So his phylogenetic analysis was enough to place the Cloverleaf eggshell that we examined within the Oo family Elongatolithidae. And the Elongatolithids have been assigned to Oviraptor dinosaurs on the basis of embryos in ovo from Asia. And so we can't say definitively that this belonged to an Oviraptorid, because we just have eggshell fragments, no associated adults or embryos in ovo. But further quantitative comparisons with Deinonychus eggshell suggests that our sample is distinct from Deinonychus. Our sample has much narrower mammillary cones, so those are structures at the inner surface of the eggshell, and they're much narrower than what we see in Deinonychus, and our eggshell is much thicker than Deinonychus as well. So we feel that this is evidence for a second theropod egg type within the cloverleaf formation. And some preliminary work that we've done to re-examine the original Maxwell and Horner material may suggest that there's a third theropod eggshell type that has visible prisms. The prisms in a long-tilithid eggshell are typically obscured by squamatic texture, but prisms are a theropod eggshell character, and so this preliminarily suggests we need to do a lot more sectioning and scanning electron microscopy of this eggshell. But this preliminarily suggests that the association that Maxwell and Horner observed between this prism-type eggshell and neonate ornithopod bones does not reflect the identity of the egg layer.
It was Tenontosaurus, right?
It may have been Tenontosaurus or Hypsilophodontid. They couldn't really tell based on the morphology of those bones. But this suggests that we don't have any evidence for any ornithopod eggshell in the cloverleaf formation right now. So this, you know, it sort of draws attention to the fact that even when you have neonate bones occurring within the same site as eggshell, that you can't make the leap to assign that eggshell to that taxon that the bones belong to. And especially in things like microsites where transport may have occurred and you know you're not dealing with an in situ assemblage.
Do you think maybe in the future we could use eggshells to like find cryptic diversity or unknown diversity within tetrapod groups?
Absolutely. I think particularly in formations in China where skeletal remains are very scarce. So I've done some work with eggshell from Zhejiang province. And so this is a province in sort of southeastern China where skeletal remains are relatively scarce. There's only about half a dozen dinosaur taxa known from there. But there's thousands upon thousands of eggs and complete clutches. And so by examining the interrelationships of those egg types, we might start to be able to more completely reconstruct that fauna than what we could do just based on skeletal remains alone.
Awesome. Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
So we're just in the lobby at on one of the lunch breaks, and I've pulled aside Ethan Cowgill, who we know from Twitter, and he's you're 14, aren't you?
Yep.
So what are you doing here if you're 14? Shouldn't you be off playing Nintendo or like I was when I was 14?
No, I just wanted to come and learn about the history of our planet and meet some of the people I've been learning about in the literature and stuff. So.
Yeah, and how are you finding it so far?
Oh, it's really cool. Learning a lot of stuff and meeting a lot of really cool people.
So the level of science here is pretty high. I'm an arthropod worker myself, and so even as a paleontologist, just trying to follow things in vertebrate paleontology, I'm finding it really hard. And so you're just getting into, well, I suppose you're not just getting into paleontology, but at this level, maybe. So are you finding it hard to follow?
A little bit. When I got here, I was really surprised how science-y it was. Like, all the presentations seemed like ninth grade science fairs. Like, oh, here's my hypothesis, here's my data. It just sounded really like textbook kind of science stuff. But it's pretty cool. I mean, everyone's checking each other and making sure no one's screwing up. And so it's pretty working good.
Anything you've learned new?
Oh, yeah. It's kind of difficult to follow some of it, but I'm learning some cool stuff. Like Arctic camels. That was pretty cool.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So how far have you come?
I came from Utah, Salt Lake City.
So it's quite a way, yeah.
Yeah, 12 to 14-hour drive.
And who brought you?
My dad brought me, because he's super nice.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah.
So is he a paleontologist as well?
No, he's not. He just knows I really like it, and he just wanted to take me here.
So he's supporting you all that way through the 14-hour drive?
Oh, yeah. Expensive, too. Especially just to come here.
That's great. So I'm guessing you're hoping to be a paleontologist in the future?
Yep.
So are you doing any activities or things towards becoming a paleontologist?
Yeah, I'm trying to get a volunteer job at the Natural History Museum of Utah, and I'm also creating a YouTube show I call the Paleo Feed,
right.
Which is
following that. That's you.
What?
I didn't know that was you.
What?
The Paleo Feed.
Really?
Yeah, I'm following that on YouTube.
I haven't made any videos yet.
I know you haven't.
Oh, all right.
You can video me.
Cool. So I'm gonna be posting a trailer pretty soon, and then I'll start making videos weekly.
All right, great.
Yeah.
So kind of a Paleo Cast inspired.
Kind of. Sure.
But better.
Yeah, I guess.
No
doubt.
Oh,
no. No way.
So, talking to people at the conference, have you found any problem in being so young? Do they look at you and just think, who's this kid walking about?
Not really. Everyone's been pretty nice. I mean, it seems like paleontologists are the nicest people on Earth.
Well, thanks very much, Ethan.
Yeah, thanks a lot, man.
Throughout my time at SVP, I've been repeatedly told to seek out Professor Jack Horner. His was the name on everyone's lips, and I finally managed to track him down in one of the breaks. Embarrassingly, as an early arthropod worker, I've had little exposure to his world of dinosaurs, and so first had to make this admission to him. However, we joined the conversation with an embarrassing admission of his own.
The first paper I wrote was about arthropods.
Yeah, what was it?
Huh?
What was it about?
It was about fossil shrimp from the late Mississippian.
Okay. Why not stick with them? Why end up researching dinosaurs? I love shrimp.
Well, they're great to eat, but I would say dinosaurs are a whole lot more interesting as animals.
Yeah. So how did you get into them? Where did you first start looking at dinosaurs?
I've been interested in dinosaurs my whole life. So I collected my first dinosaur when I was 8, found my first skeleton when I was, in high school.
Oh, wow.
So I've been doing this my whole life.
Okay, so I've heard that you've discovered Egg Mountain. Could you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Well, Egg Mountain is a site where we discovered the first evidence of dinosaur nesting, the first evidence of eggs in the Western Hemisphere, the first dinosaur embryos. You know, it's a cool place that gives us insights into nesting, basically into the social behavior of dinosaurs.
And how long ago was this? Was this pretty early on in your career?
Yeah, it really sort of jump-started it. It was, we found the first baby dinosaurs in nests in 1978, and Egg Mountain was discovered in 79, and late 70s, early 80s, and that research still goes on. We still work there.
Are you still producing material then?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, and then I've heard a lot about Jurassic Park. Now, you probably get asked about this a lot. I can't remember the name of the lead character now.
Alan Grant.
Alan Grant. Was he based on you?
That's what they say, yeah.
That's the rumor I've heard, yeah. So did you have to liaise with all of the Jurassic Park production team about that, or did they
I was not only the... Not only was the character based on me, I was also the technical advisor, so I worked very closely with Steven Spielberg and the producers and everybody.
It must have been a pretty interesting time. How long did you did it take to produce the film?
Well, the Jurassic Park, the first one, I don't know, it's a long process, so... There's pre-production and then there's production, and I was basically Steven Spielberg's assistant when he wanted information. So I, it lasted for the entire production, and then I was also involved in Jurassic Park 2, The Lost World, and Jurassic Park 3, and I'm heavily involved in Jurassic Park 4.
Where's that in production?
It's not in production yet. It's in pre-production right now.
Any inside info on what that's going to be about?
I can't tell you. I'm sworn to secrecy here.
And back in the real world, have you been doing anything with dinosaur DNA or anything Jurassic Park related?
Well, I wouldn't call it Jurassic Park related, but we have what we call the Dino Chicken Project. Our attempt to retro-engineer a dinosaur-like animal from a bird. Birds are dinosaurs' descendants, and so we're looking for what we call atavistic genes that have been silenced through evolution, and we're looking to turn those back on again and see if we can't resurrect some of the more recently more recent characteristics that have been silenced.
Okay, so it's more like you're bringing back traits and characters, right, than the actual dinosaurs,
exactly,
themselves.
But, you know, when you take a bird and add a tail to it and transform its wings back into arms, you have an animal that looks pretty much like a raptor.
And so you think it's feasible to do this?
Well, I've got a big project to attempt to do it, so I'm sure hoping it's feasible.
And here at this conference, you're being given an award. Can you tell us what that's for?
Well, I don't know. Hard to tell what awards are for, you know? I mean, you go along, you do what you do, and you have fun doing it, and somewhere away along the way, somebody says, I don't know, we're going to give you an award for it. I don't know. You got me. I just have fun. And it seems kind of weird to get an award for something, you know, when you're... It seems like awards should be for people who don't like what they do rather than, yeah, what, you know, people like myself who love what I do.
So it doesn't sound like a bad life doing what you're doing, having all the fun you're doing, and then getting a lifetime award for it.
Well, I'm just getting revved up, so it seems kind of funny to get a lifetime achievement award.
Exactly. So what's really next for Jack Horner?
I'm working on Jurassic Park 4 and all of our big projects, Hell Creek Project, collecting more Triceratops and T-Rexes, and all that's still going on, looking at dinosaur growth and behavior, and I don't know.
And you still enjoying it?
Absolutely. I love it.
Jack Horner, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by The Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
And finally, we've got David Elliott from the Northern Arizona University, and he's got a poster on the predation of early vertebrates by Eurypterids. So I'm very, very happy to see this poster. I've been waiting for 4 days. I saw it in the abstracts. So can you tell us about Eurypterids eating vertebrates, please?
Well, I guess we shouldn't really be talking about invertebrates at a vertebrate meeting, but still, the situation here is that we... have some evidence from bitten shields of agnathans in the Devonian that Eurypterids were capable of actually gripping them, holding them, and we postulate that they were then capable of feeding on them by probably pulling them apart and shredding them in order to be able to feed.
And what kind of Eurypterid would be doing this?
Well, we're able to fit the chela of Eucalopterus to to the puncture marks in a shield. So we're pretty clear that probably Aeacaloptris was the predator in this case. Difficult at the moment to decide which others could have been doing the same thing.
And how big is that one? Isn't that the biggest Eurypterid?
Yeah, this particular one wouldn't have been all that big, but they do get up to about 8 feet in length. So the sort of thing you don't want to meet when you're out swimming.
So it's a kind of a nice way to leave our coverage of the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology Conference with an 8-foot Eurypterid tearing poor little vertebrates to shreds. So thanks very much, Dave. You've made my day.
Thank you.